Hey guys, I'm Katie.
And I'm Rebecca.
And this is Chills,
Thrills,
and Kills.
Yay!
Every time.
One day we won't have the urge to add something after that and we'll just be able to get right into it. But today is not that day.
You know, and it probably won't be that day next week either. I mean, it took us a while to get used to not saying podcast. So just hold on.
Yes, hold on to your hats, your seats, your butts, whatever. We'll get there.
Yeah. Slowly but surely, but it's coming. Just be patient.
Yeah. So this week is finally the wrap-up of this wild, wild case. it just... God, you guys, I didn't even finish my notes for it until yesterday. It has just been a lot. So, I am going to start with a sum up of what we've already talked about, which is an entire page of notes in and of itself. So, here we go. So far, we've discussed the bank robbery that took place on August 28th, 2003, in which a man named Brian Wells robbed a bank holding a cane gun with a bomb strapped to his neck. According to his own words, he was kidnapped while delivering pizzas, had the bomb strapped to him, then was handed a 9-page instruction letter, which included a scavenger hunt to get all of the keys required to get the bomb off. Now, if you recall, it takes 4 separate keys plus a combination lock, and some of those keys don't necessarily need to be used, so super complicated.
For no reason.
For no reason! Wells was then apprehended by police before he could complete the scavenger hunt, and in front of the world on live television, the bomb detonated, killing Wells and taking many of the answers with him. His co-worker, Robert Thomas Panetti, died just a few days later, one day before he could be interviewed by state police or the FBI. The cause of his death was an overdose, but no further information could be concluded. Such a long week, you guys.
Yep.
And we're actually recording on a Sunday, so I can say that this time.
Yeah, we haven't recorded on a Sunday in like 3 weeks.
I know, it's been wild. I think wild's my favorite word. So when I say no further information could be concluded, that means we don't know if it was a suicide, we don't know if it was just an accidental drug overdose from recreational drug use, we don't know if it was a murder. My bet's on it was a murder. Mm-hmm. Or that it was a suicide because of guilt. But who knows? On September 20th, 2003, a phone call was made to the state police by Bill Rothstein. There was a body in his chest freezer. This body belonged to James or Jim Roden, current/former boyfriend of Marjorie Deal Armstrong, who happened to be Bill Rothstein's ex-girlfriend. Weird.
Mm-hmm.
Rothstein admitted to hiding the body, but said he couldn't bring himself to destroy it and therefore turned her into the police. Armstrong, who had once killed another boyfriend in 1984 and had several other boyfriends and one husband die mysterious and untimely deaths, eventually admitted to killing Roden and was sentenced to a mental institution. At this point, Armstrong began corresponding with the producer of Netflix's Evil Genius, whose name is Trey. I'm not going to try and pronounce his last name. So she started corresponding with him in exchange for legal help. She also pointed police in the direction of Kenneth Barnes for an unrelated crime in the hopes that they would move her closer to home. Unfortunately for her, pointing them in the direction of Kenneth Barnes would completely backfire eventually. Meanwhile, investigators found a folder titled Snitch Letters. In this folder were several letters from Armstrong's fellow inmate, Kelly Michaela. So Michaela, being the badass bitch that she was, kept detailed notes on everything Armstrong had said, including one statement that Rothstein one statement that Rothstein had masterminded the heist and his roommate Floyd Stockton was involved. These letters also noted that Armstrong had said the frozen body case was tied to the heist. Investigators then interviewed Stockton, Rothstein's roommate, who was currently in prison on rape charges.
Yikes.
In the initial interview, Stockton wouldn't reveal much more than the fact that both Rothstein and Armstrong were involved in the heist and bomb plot because they needed money. Eventually, the FBI looked deeper into Kenneth Barnes after Gluth, the police officer brought onto the FBI case, suggested he knew more than he was letting on. During this interview, Barnes admitted that Marjorie had solicited him to the heist as well as murder her father. He also stated that Wells himself was in on the heist. And that set in motion a chain of events that would eventually cause Barnes to testify against Armstrong. Floyd Stockton would also eventually confess to his role in the heist and testify against Armstrong in exchange for immunity. In July of 2007, a federal grand jury indicted both Barnes and Armstrong on the felonies of armed bank robbery, conspiracy to commit armed bank robbery, and using a destructive device in a crime of violence. Both Wells and Rothstein were named as co-conspirators. Refresh over!
Woo! That is a lot of information.
That is, my mind feels like pudding, and I'm going to take a sip of water. All right. Seriously, though, with that level of information, you guys, there's a reason this is a three-parter. Mm-hmm. Now we are going to start off from Wells and Rothstein being announced as co-conspirators, and Barnes and Armstrong being co-defendants. So, during the trial, a witness came forward stating that they had nearly hit Wells with their vehicle while driving past Rothstein's home just one day prior to the robbery. So this would have been when the pre-heist meeting previously mentioned by Barnes took place. Mm-hmm. So because it appeared that Wells was in on the heist to a certain extent, the death penalty was not on the table for involvement in his death. Which, I guess I get it, but I think that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
In 2008, Barnes pleaded guilty to federal charges of conspiracy to commit bank robbery and carrying a destructive device. He was sentenced to serve 45 years. However, in 2011, a judge reduced his sentence to only half, reducing it to 22 and a half years.
What? Why?
Fuck if I know.
Okay.
Yeah, that was my question too, but doesn't really matter. Barnes wasn't really fazed either way. As he said, he was enjoying his time in prison.
Oh. Okay.
He enjoyed being clean and off of drugs, and that he didn't have to struggle with his addiction. He also liked that he was being taken care of.
Ah, okay.
Which, like, honestly, I can kind of relate to, but being taken care of sounds nice right about now. Mm-hmm. Marjorie Deal Armstrong, on the other hand, of course, pleaded not guilty. At first, she was determined to be too unstable. She was determined to be too unstable to assist in her own defense. After a lot of treatment, Armstrong was finally declared competent. However, by the time this occurred, Stockton, who, remember, traded immunity for his cooperation in court, was no longer able to stand trial as he needed heart surgery.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. But he still got his immunity, don't worry.
Of course he did.
Yeah. October 15th, 2010, Luke's birthday! The official trial was underway. Trey, the producer, showed up and sat behind the prosecution. Armstrong actually noticed this and called out, "What are you doing over there?"
Okay.
Yeah, so he moved and sat behind her, but, like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
So, throughout the trial, Armstrong would act out, but would always stop just before the judge would admonish her. During breaks, and this part is, the weirdest, she would actually turn around and talk with the people in the seats behind her.
Why?
I don't fucking know. This girl, like, mental issues aside, this girl is fucking nuts.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I can't even imagine, like, having that, sitting at a trial and having her just turn around and be like, so, how are you?
Yeah, what? How's the weather out there?
Bitch, what? What?
Like, who are you?
Okay.
So wild. While Armstrong tried to deny any involvement, Jessica Hoopsick, the sex worker with ties to both Wells and Barnes, took the stand and stated that she had been on the porch the day of this pre-heist meeting and heard a woman's voice instructing. That voice supposedly belonged to Armstrong. When Armstrong finally took the stand, she broke down in tears about how abusive and difficult her childhood was.
Oh, of course.
Of course. Like, I was heavily abused as a kid, and you don't see me fucking murdering people with a bomb around their neck, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, or in general. Let me just put that out there. Prosecuting attorneys were actually genuinely concerned, though, that it might have been enough to sway the jury.
Oh, God.
Personally, I feel like had I been there, I wouldn't have been even remotely concerned because of her other behavior on the stand, which I feel would have negated any sympathy she may have gained. She would actually belittle her attorney on the stand and tell him he was asking her stupid questions.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. She also said something along the lines of, if this is all the evidence you have against me, this is a pitiful case. I'll tell you that much.
Oh. Bold.
I mean, so everybody claims she was the super intelligent person, but a super intelligent person would know you don't act like that if you're trying to appear innocent.
Yeah, you would think that.
You would think, but who am I to say I don't have 5 college degrees? But on the first day of her being on the stand, because she was on the stand for 2 days, she only mentioned Wells once. It was in the final 10 minutes of her testimony. And she said, I never met Brian Wells, and I never knew Brian Wells. Never. I became aware of him the day that he died. I saw it on the news.
Sure.
Which, like, also, that's extremely unbelievable to me that you never met him, you never saw him, and you were never aware of him when you live in this extremely small town.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I've never lived in a small town, so maybe I'm wrong, but that just seems a little strange to me.
I mean, typically, like, I grew up in a very small town, so there are still people I don't know personally, but that doesn't mean that I don't know of them. So that is probably kind of hard. She would at least probably have known who he was.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyways. After 10 days of testimony, the jury began deliberations and reached a verdict 1.5 days later. The jury found Armstrong guilty on all counts. So those counts were conspiracy to commit armed bank robbery in which death resulted, use of a destructive device, and furtherance of a crime with violence. Upon this verdict being read aloud, Marjorie shouted at her lawyer, "You didn't do your job."
Oh my God. She's really making a case for herself.
Oh my Lord. And then she turned to the gallery and said, There will be an appeal, I'll tell you that.
This bitch.
If okay. nothing else, she had the audacity. That is all I'm going to say.
All of it. She had all the audacity.
Oh, lovely, lovely.
Lovely.
Also, Audacity editing program, sponsor us. I'm sorry. I'm stupid. I got, like, no sleep. But anyways, during sentencing, the judge actually addressed the courtroom and stated, and this is just a summary of some of the things he stated because it was, like, a really long statement. So the judge said, the defendant has a long history of mental illness, but there are people with these conditions who do not solicit others to kill their father or shoot someone in cold blood to silence a perceived threat. Or seal a man's fate by strapping a ticking bomb to his neck.
Bingo.
Yeah. Marjorie Deal Armstrong was sentenced to life plus 30. At this point, Armstrong continued to insist she was innocent. She also felt that she was the only one being punished. After all, Stockton had received immunity and Barnes was enjoying his sentence. Plus, Bill Rothstein had already died. So she wasn't, like, she didn't feel that it was fair that she was the only one being punished, which I kind of agree with.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Yeah. By 2013, Armstrong had used up all of her appeals, all of which were denied.
Wow.
But she didn't lie. There would be an appeal. Many.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now that there was no way she would be released, Trey, again, the producer of the Netflix series, and I just keep telling you guys what she does or what everybody does, not because I think you're stupid, but because I myself cannot keep these names straight. Mm-hmm. There are just a lot of people involved.
Yeah, that is very true.
Yeah, so Trey, the producer, asked Marjorie whether or not Wells was involved. She was absolutely adamant that he was and that she was innocent. So, one thing to take into account here is that in Pennsylvania, there's no statute of limitations on murder.
Okay.
Which there should not be. No. So, good. And admitting that Wells wasn't involved could have opened her up to more charges and the death penalty.
Oh.
Yeah. So, even if... So, like, at this point, she says, yes, he was absolutely involved. That could be completely untrue. Mm-hmm. And she could only be insisting that, as well as all of the others could be insisting he was involved, just because they know that the second they say he wasn't, they could face the death penalty.
Right.
Yeah, just how, like, the Golden State Killer admitted to everything because he didn't want to face the death penalty, so... Shortly after his conversation with her, Jessica Hoopsick was brought into prison on drug charges. She and Trey actually began speaking, and for a long while she wouldn't give Trey much information, but she insisted that Wells was innocent and that he was a good guy. There was actually at one point some kind of altercation between Marjorie and Hoopsick, who were both in the same prison, and neither one would tell Trey what that altercation was about, but Marjorie had also found out that Trey was talking with Hoopsick, and she was very not happy about that.
I bet.
Yeah, because she's like, you already have my testimony. You already know I'm innocent. Why are you talking to other people? Ugh, so weird.
Yeah.
After Hoopsick's release, though, she actually confessed to Trey on camera. So this confession can be seen in the docuseries on Netflix. There's some controversy about that confession, though, so I will bring that up a little bit later.
Okay.
So Hoopsick stated that she had been involved in the heist. She was responsible for finding the gopher to rob the bank. She was told to find someone who could be easily scared into doing the robbery, and that the bomb would be fake. So after being high for 3 days, she gave Brian Wells' name to Kenneth Barnes, which I will say is a little weird to me. Why would Kenneth Barnes even need to be given Brian Wells' name when Kenneth supposedly already knows who Wells is.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just there's a lot of holes in everybody's story.
Mm-hmm.
She then brought Wells over so that the group could see who Wells was and then left, which, again, Kenneth Barnes supposedly already knows who Wells is. So they received his work schedule from Hoopsick so they could carry out their plan. Hoopsick also swore that on the day of the meeting, she'd been with him from 12 to 2:30, and his shift began at 4, which led several people to believe that there was no way he was able to go to this meeting, then get ready, and get to work on time.
I guess it depends on how long it would take him to get ready, but okay.
I mean, there's a lot of different caveats to that. Like, when they were hanging out, was he wearing his work uniform already? What was his work uniform? How far away was his work? How long does it take him to get ready? Like, there are a lot of, there's just a lot of things that unless you have more information, there's no way to determine, well, okay, no, it wouldn't have been possible. Or, yeah, it absolutely was. Why is this a question?
Right, there's not enough details.
Yeah. And that never changes, you guys. So if you were looking for closure, prepare to be disappointed.
Great.
Yeah, this, it bothers me for so many reasons. Trey then brought this information to Ken Barnes, who insisted that Jessica was lying. His version of events to talk himself out of it this time began to directly contradict the story that had been told prior. Because of course it did.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah. I mean, at this point, it doesn't really seem like many facts are fully being taken into consideration. So why not? Who cares?
Yeah.
This time, rather than him and Armstrong just having arrived to the location, him, Armstrong, and Rothstein were apparently all eating the pizza while Wells waited to get paid on the day of the robbery. Okay. Which... I don't know if you've ever ordered pizza, but, like, you pay first. You have to.
Yeah.
So, if they're already eating pizza, either why would Wells be waiting to get paid, or why were they ordering another pizza?
Well, I don't know. I guess unless they paid cash upon delivery. I don't know.
Well, I mean, even if you pay cash upon delivery, he still wouldn't be waiting to be paid while other people, like, while they're eating. It just doesn't.
Right.
I don't know. It's, again, it's weird.
Mm-hmm.
He also said, this time, that there was no day before meeting, and that Wells didn't know what day the heist was supposed to take place.
Wow.
So, so then that also directly opens Hoopsick up to perjury charges for saying, oh yeah, I was there the day of this meeting. There was very clearly a woman's voice instructing people, which then opens up, well, so was Marjorie really the mastermind? Was she even a part of it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I absolutely 100% believe she was a part of it because bitch is fucking crazy, but...
Yeah. To what extent, I guess.
Yeah, to what extent. So, now he wasn't at this meeting the day before, as there wasn't one to begin with, and Marjorie continued to declare her innocence. Shortly after the heist, Jessica Hoopsick gave birth to a child she says she believes to be the child of Brian Wells.
Oh, God.
Mm-hmm. Many believe that Wells had been involved in the heist up until the point he became an unwitting victim, you know, when the bomb turned out to be real, that Armstrong was the mastermind, and that Rothstein was simply in on it.
Okay.
Retired criminal investigator Jim Fisher doesn't buy any of that. He never really stated whether or not he believed that Wells had been involved, at least as far as I could find, but as for the other things, he's just like, there's no way.
Mm-hmm.
So, this isn't somebody who actually worked the case, but he did follow it extremely closely and studied every piece of evidence there was to be found. So, according to Fisher, there's no way that Marjorie Deal Armstrong planned the collar bomb heist. One thing he points to as proof is the FBI's profile. In addition to the personality traits, practically describing Rothstein to a fucking T, It also states that it read much more than a bank robbery. It was a choreographed attempt to direct others to do as he wanted, or as they wanted, rather. Mm-hmm. It was believed by FBI that money wasn't the primary motive, but that there were multiple other motives. And that makes a fuck ton of sense, because why would they strap a bomb to the person who's supposed to bring the money back to them?
Right.
Fisher stated that whoever planned the heist didn't really care whether or not Wells ever delivered the money, but that they wanted to craft a puzzle so confusing that no one would ever be able to fully solve it.
Well, good job.
Fucking right. If money wasn't the main motive, could this really be attributed to Armstrong, whose only motive appeared to be that she needed money to pay a hitman to murder her father? Mm-hmm. Fisher believes that Rothstein was the more likely mastermind, which, does anybody not believe this?
Yeah, I was gonna say.
After all, the initial profile stated the bomb builder was comfortable around a wide variety of power tools and shop machines. Rothstein. He was a pack rat who saved materials in order to reuse them. Rothstein. Mm-hmm. And he was the type of person who takes pride in building a variety of things. Rothstein. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know how in-depth I really covered Rothstein's personality in, like, growing into adulthood, but he basically never finished a fucking thing in his life.
Likely.
He knew a lot about, or he knew a little bit about a lot.
Yeah, okay. That sounds about right.
Yeah, so I think at one point he went to get like his pilot's license, but then he didn't finish that. He went to school for a couple of things, but he never got his degree. So he was living in his dead parents' house. Just, I don't even fucking know what he was doing with his life, but basically Fisher thinks that this was kind of like his last hurrah. Mm-hmm. Of, look, I can fucking accomplish something. Look how smart I am. Yeah, so super fun. Fisher believes that Rothstein concocted the scavenger hunt partly to send police on a useless chase in the most important hours of the investigation. Then he called 911 about the body in the freezer so that he could begin framing the investigation as he wished before one of his co-conspirators could do the same. Just fucking, like, you couldn't write this shit.
No. I mean, maybe Rothstein could write it, because there's so many open-ended questions.
I mean, fucking apparently he could, because he did. But, like, if you were to put this in a movie before this happened, nobody would believe it.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, it would be very much like everybody's reaction to coronavirus right now, where it's like, I need to apologize to every horror movie ever where I said, oh, no, they wouldn't directly ignore science like that. Whoops, sorry.
Yeah, this whole year has been definite proof of that.
Yeah, so it would be very much that situation if somebody were to have made a movie about this before this heist occurred. He believes Rothstein's goal wasn't the money, but was to prove once and for all that he was brilliant. And to do this, he would execute a crime that would baffle authorities. All co-conspirators were people he felt he could control and keep crucial plot details from, which would only prove to further complicate the investigation. Because certain people had one part of the puzzle, other people had a different part, and they didn't necessarily match up. Mm-hmm. And my favorite thing to draw into this whole theory is, remember how I said Rothstein's first words in his interview with FBI agent Jerry Clark were, I want you to know something, just off the top. I'm the smartest guy in the room. I mean, had it been me investigating, obviously hindsight's 20/20, so I could be completely wrong. But the second somebody's first words in an investigation or in an interrogation are, well, I'm smarter than you, you're suspect number one, buddy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Just based off of everything we know about serial killers and other criminals, yeah, you're guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Or as they say in Duncanville, ya gilpy. Sorry, Luke and I like yell that at each other all the time, and it's my favorite thing. All right. Fisher, like many, believes that we will never know the true answers because Bill Rothstein took them with him to his grave.
Absolutely, and that is so frustrating.
That pisses me the fuck off! In regards to whether or not Wells was involved, lead FBI agent Jerry Clark seems to think that it'd be ridiculous to believe that he wasn't.
I could see that.
I can see both sides of it, and I honestly just, at the end of this, I can't even give an opinion. I don't know what the fuck to think.
Yeah.
Other than that Bill Rothstein spearheaded this whole fucking thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
He believes that the only part of Hoop Six's confession that was true was that she introduced the group to Wells. So, in a direct quote to TMZ, he stated, quite honestly, if you look at co-defendants, witnesses, and everyone else we talked to related to having any information in the case, there is nothing in Jessica's statement that appears to be accurate.
Mm-hmm.
He does, however, agree that Rothstein was likely the mastermind behind the way the heist played out, while the initial idea to rob the bank came from Armstrong. Now, what's really strange to me, though, is that so Jerry Clark says that he believes Bill Rothstein was the mastermind, but throughout this entire docuseries, he seems to go extremely easy on Bill and then, like, demonizes Marjorie, which, like, she's fucking nuts. But, like, I don't know. Just the whole conversation behind the docuseries was really, really weird. Like, they let Bill off real fucking easy.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously he died before being punished, but no. One of the lead investigators on the fucking case thinks that Bill Rothstein was the main guy, but Marjorie was tried as the fucking, like, he was just charged as a co-conspirator, essentially.
Okay.
I don't know. It confuses me. That's not even in my notes at this point. I'm just ranting because I'm mad. On the other side of Jerry, many believe that Brian Wells just was not capable of being involved. So if you take Hoop Six's confession as true, it could make sense that he wasn't innocent in all of this. Let's just look back for a minute. So, Brian Wells was frequently described as childlike. One New York Times article stated that he was shy with people, but animated with pets. So, the kind of person who would literally get on all fours to play with a neighbor's dog. I don't know, and this might come off as extremely sexist. I'm not trying to say men can't love animals. That's not where I'm going with this. I'm just saying I don't know many 46-year-old men who are about to get down on their hands and knees and play with a neighbor's dog.
I know a bunch of them, but
I don't know. But anyway, so he's described as childlike, really shy around people, animated with pets. At 46 years old, he worked as a pizza delivery driver and slept on a mattress on the floor.
Okay.
When he went to the bank, he initially stood in line and, whether or not you believe the bomb around your neck is real, you know intuitively when committing a crime that you want to get in and get the fuck out as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Not stand around giving people time to, I don't know, thwart your actions, put you in jail, something along those lines.
Right.
Then after finally deciding to actually cut ahead and approach a bank teller, he took a lollipop from the fucking counter. Depending on how you look at it, the taking a lollipop and waiting in line could read as cocky, could read as overconfident, or, I don't know, nervousness, or perhaps someone with an intellectual disability.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if his supposed co-conspirators demanded $250,000, why was Wells not fazed when he didn't receive even a quarter of that?
Right.
There are just so many things that... Also, if he was in on it, they live in such a small fucking town, as I've mentioned, why wouldn't he be wearing a face covering if he'd been in on it?
Yeah.
Then factor in Wells' family statement, which said that he wasn't capable of committing the crime. Now, while that could simply mean they didn't think he had it in him, like, personality-wise, combined with everything else we know about him and his actions this day, it could possibly mean something deeper.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't found any other statements from his family that really clear up that assessment at all. It's just one of the many, 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 many theories that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
The next question would be, what motive could Hoopsick have had for her confession had it been false? Coming forward would have opened her up to, as I said, charges of perjury,
mm-hmm.
as well as charges of being a co-conspirator, because she just openly admitted to enrolling some innocent person into this crime in exchange for money. What on earth would possess a person to admit to that if it wasn't true?
Yeah.
So some people think that it's possible she came forward simply so that she could say Wells fathered her child, and then potentially have the opportunity to file a wrongful death suit against the state later.
What?
That, to me, seems pretty far-fetched. Like, you could... I mean, I guess you can't file a wrongful death suit if he's guilty, right?
Yeah.
So, like, that kind of makes sense. But she'd still be in prison for perjury. So.
This is a lot.
Yeah, the logistics are just really fucking weird. And then not to mention, if she's lying, which a lot of people believe she's lying about the kid being the child of Wells,
mm-hmm.
you can prove that with a fucking blood test.
Yeah, I was gonna say...
To his family members.
Any family member.
Like, anyone individually.
Mm-hmm.
I just... It is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But... While Hoopsick may not be the most credible witness because, you know, she's a drug addict, as far as I'm aware. I don't know if she's still a drug addict. And, you know, everybody's beef with sex workers. I personally don't find them to be untrustworthy, but that's just me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily believe that taking the words of those already imprisoned is really a good option either.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, extra charges.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, even if the truth were ever to be discovered, there wouldn't be anybody left to charge with the murder of Brian Wells. Bill Rothstein died of lymphoma in July of 2004. Marjorie Deal Armstrong died of breast cancer on April 4th, 2017.
Mm-hmm.
Kenneth Barnes died of poor health in prison on June 20th, 2019.
Jesus.
And when I say poor health, it's like complications of diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And Stockton, I couldn't find whether or not he died, so I'm assuming he's still alive. He was granted immunity. And I'm not super certain that it would apply to murder charges should they arise, but it's very unlikely that there would ever be any evidence to clear Wells' name at this point.
Doesn't seem likely.
One fun fact, just to end this little section with, because this is literally the last sentence, was that the prosecutor in Armstrong's trial described the crime as ludicrous, overwrought, overworked, desperately failed plan.
Sounds good.
Yeah, very accurate, and I just tried to lighten it a little bit. So, like with the last two episodes, all of my sources, because there is like a giant handful of them, are going to be in the episode notes, because I don't think you want an extra 2 minutes of me just reading them off.
Yeah.
All right, we are going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, Rebecca, guess what?
What?
I got my Heathen Hippo candle in the mail today.
Really? So did I.
Yeah, so I got the fireside scent, and it is literally my favorite thing in the world right now.
I got my white tea and fig scent, and same.
Yeah, they're amazing. Not to mention, our cute little logo looks so good on the front of this candle.
I 100% agree, and I don't know. I want to send one to everyone.
Same. They're super affordable. They're natural because they're made out of soy.
And because they're made out of soy and they're natural, they burn evenly, there's no lingering smoky smell, and they even use my favorite wood wicks.
Yeah, so that nice little crackle, oh my goodness.
Especially with fireside, I imagine that would be so nice.
Yeah, it's literally like I'm sitting next to a campfire in my cramped little studio. It's perfect.
I love it. So, guys, if you want one, there are 9 fragrances, 5 customizable font options, or you can get some of their really fun standard label options. They have some Joe Exotic ones that are calling my name. So, if you want to buy some of these adorable, affordable candles, go to Heathen Hippo on Etsy.
And you can use our little code, CTKPOD, and save 10%.
Yeah, so literally not seeing any reason you shouldn't do that.
So, head on over right now. Like, right now.
Right now, do it.
Hello, my name is Eric Phillips, and I host a true crime podcast called Find Me in the Dark, along with my lifelong friend, Robert Prestige. We cover all things true crime, from murder and kidnappings all the way to arson and mass shootings.
You can find us on Spotify, Google, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, YouTube, Podbean, and bonus content on Patreon for as low as $5 a month. We look forward to talking crime with you, and thanks for listening.
Okay, and we're back.
We're back! And Katie is about to scare the crap out of me, hopefully.
Yeah.
Yay, I'm in a little blanket for it at the moment, so this is perfect. It feels like childhood.
Perfect. So I've been really into, like, anthologies lately. Like, TV shows, podcasts, whatever. So I'm like, it's kind of like an anthology, kind of not, where it's just a bunch of little stories, kind of like how we've done a couple of our itty-bitties. So I'm going to be covering urban legends.
Yay!
And I think we've discussed before that you've never seen the urban legend movies. So are you familiar with, like, a bunch of urban legends? Because I tried to pick some that are kind of well-known, some that are not well-known, and there's a few that are actually true.
So there are a few urban legends that I'm familiar with because, like, they're covered in the show Grimm.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, not really.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right. And I tried to find most of the ones I found I'm not familiar with. So it was new information to me as well, because I think that is more exciting that way.
I agree.
All right. So the first one I'm going to cover is called Alabama's Hellgate Bridge.
Definitely haven't heard that one.
Me neither. It popped up and I was like, what is this? And this is a pretty short one. The first few are pretty short. So this takes place, the beginning of this takes place in the 1950s. So there are two parts to the legend for this bridge. The first one says, and this, so there's a bridge like this in every state. So I found the story's always a little different, but it always ends up similar, with similar results, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But the first one says, if you drive your car out to the middle of Hell's Gate Bridge and turn off the lights, a couple who drove their car over the bridge and drowned will appear in your car, leaving your seats wet, which I would be mad as hell about.
Yeah, don't fuck up my car. The seats are not leather. I don't have time for that.
No, and I don't want you in my car to begin with, but okay.
Yeah, definitely not.
But apparently you can see the couple in your rearview mirror, and then when you turn around to look, there's just two massive wet spots on your seat, which is just disgusting. Yeah. And then the second part of this one says, if you drive over the bridge and look in your rearview mirror, once reaching the middle of the bridge, you'll see that all the scenery is now engulfed in flames and is showing a portal to hell, which is, of course, where the bridge got its name. I read a couple of people's accounts on this, and I kind of think, because they say that you're supposed to do it at, like, sunset, I'm kind of thinking maybe people are just really wanting to see this, and, like, the sunlight is making everything look super orange.
I don't
really buy that. I just thought it was interesting because there are a few people that have said they've done this multiple times. So, you know, it's out there.
Yeah, I mean, the sunset thing definitely makes sense. But also, hell to me doesn't look like flames. It just kind of looks like life here in America right now.
Yeah,
so.
That's what I was gonna say. Yeah. the bridge is currently not stable enough for cars to drive over, and walking is strongly discouraged because of the shape that the bridge is in. So that was the first one I thought was kind of interesting.
What shape is this bridge in that they discourage walking on it?
Okay, so I pulled up recent pictures of this bridge, and I honestly think that they're trying to keep the foot traffic off of it, just because it's an old metal bridge, so it's not stable enough for your car to go over, obviously, but, it's not exactly falling apart. It's just, like, old and rusted, so I'm thinking it's more of, like, a public safety hazard.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's, you know, it's a bridge, it was built by the state, if someone was to get hurt on it and there's no signs posted saying you can't go across it, you could sue the state, basically.
Oh, I mean, absolutely, it makes sense. But, like, why would they say the shape of the bridge?
Like, the condition.
Okay. Yeah. I was like, what, is it round? And at which point, how do cars drive over?
No, the condition, I guess I should have said that. but
no, I'm just dumb. Continue.
But yeah, apparently people, of course, still go there and walk across it and all that. I guess it's not really as relevant if you don't drive, because everything kind of surrounds around you being in a vehicle.
I guess.
But yeah. That was that one.
Well, I like that one, and I hate it, so good job.
Oh, good. So my next one is coming out of Connecticut, and it is a legend about a woman named Hannah Crana, which I didn't think was a real name until I found her gravestone.
Would it be bad if I said it made me think about crayons?
It made me think of crayons, too.
I also just learned, so, like, apparently people put crayons in their emergency preparedness kits because I guess you can light them on fire mm-hmm. for, like, lighting. But at which point I go, why not just put a fucking flashlight and some batteries?
Yeah.
I don't, continue. Unrelated. Hannah Crana.
Okay, so, Hannah Crana was also known as the Wicked Witch of Monroe. She got this reputation because her husband and her were on a hike and he mysteriously fell off of a cliff.
Ooh, cute look. Cute moment.
Right. So instead of people coming up with her pushing him, the rumor started to spread that she had bewitched him and made him fall off the cliff to his death.
That makes more sense.
Yeah. And it was also said that people that would piss her off would... their crops wouldn't grow correctly, their livestock would die off, family members would get sick, and so they basically said she was a witch because if you pissed her off, all these bad things would happen to you, which, I mean, I'm not saying it's not true.
I don't know. I think people like to blame women for a lot of ridiculous things.
Oh yeah, absolutely. All I'm saying. Absolutely. I definitely agree with that. So right before Hannah died, she actually requested that her coffin be carried by foot. So she wanted a group of men from the town to carry her coffin on their shoulders to her burial site. It was the only request that she had as far as her arrangements went. She left no instruction as to what was to happen to her belongings or her home or anything like that. It was literally the only thing that she wanted. And other than people thinking she was a witch, apparently she was also very well liked just because she was very open and friendly, and she helped a lot of the townspeople with, you know, small tasks and things like that. So I guess unless you pissed her off, she was a great gal. Of course, when she died, the townspeople tried to place her coffin in a wagon to take it down to her burial site. They tried this for about 10 feet, and the coffin began to roll off the back of the wagon. They tried multiple times, and it just kept falling off. It would fall off the side, fall off the back. They couldn't move the wagon at one point, so the men ended up having to carry the wagon down to her burial site.
Well, good. It was her one last fucking wish. Come on.
Right. Her only last wish. So she was making sure that it was fulfilled. After they carried her coffin to her burial site, everybody returned back to her home, I guess to kind of pick over her belongings because she never said what was to be done with them. And all of this townspeople walked up to her home and saw that it was engulfed in flames. And apparently the entire town was at her burial, so there was no one to set the house on fire. It, of course, wasn't an electrical thing because this was in the late 1800s. So apparently they try to say that as soon as she was set in the ground, the house became engulfed in flames. But who can really tell exactly when that happened?
Yeah, especially if, I don't know, you're not there.
Right. That is Connecticut's urban legend on Hannah Karina. Apparently, if you go to her gravesite, you can still, like, feel weird vibes and stuff like that. But that's pretty much the only after effects, and she was a real person. I'll definitely include a picture of her gravestone, and if I can find a picture of her, we'll try to include that as well on Patreon or on the Facebook group.
One thing I will say, though, about that weird vibe is, like, I feel like that's every cemetery.
Yeah, and that's just people entering the cemetery with that mindset to begin with. But her gravesite is on its own. Like, it's on the side of the road somewhere.
That's weird.
And it's, she's, like, completely by herself. So I kind of think, you know, you know you're going to stumble upon this grave. Like, you're going there, obviously. It's the only one around. So you already have that, like, mentality that it's creepy and spooky. So, of course, you're going to get super weird feelings.
That actually totally reminds me. So I forgot to mention, Marjorie was actually buried in an unmarked grave in Texas.
What?
Yeah, I don't know why. Oh, and then apparently there's also some guy that, like, insists he's her, like, husband by some weird law loophole and is like, I want her body moved, but they won't acknowledge him as her husband.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, I don't know. Sorry to bogart that, but I completely, like, graveside on the side of the road just made me think of it.
Yeah. So before I go into my next one, I'm going to go ahead and cite my sources just so I don't forget. So I used Wikipedia, Insider.com, UrbanLegendsOnline.com, LiveAbout.com, MentalFloss.com, and Snopes.com.
Okay.
Just to get that out of the way.
Snopes confuses me. Like, I can't tell what part they're saying is true and what isn't now that they did their weird highlighting thing, and I just can't.
Yeah, I only used that to figure out someone's name, and it didn't play out too well for me, but because I visited the site, just in case I did write down some information from there, I just wanted to include it.
Makes sense.
Okay, the next one is one of my favorite urban legends. I'm not going to give the title of it just because it's going to give away the entire story, so I'll just dive into the story.
Ooh, okay.
So there were two female college roommates. It doesn't say what college. There's, like, several versions of the story, so there's a million different names, so I didn't even include any names in this. So there's just two female college roommates. They met, of course, when they showed up to their dorm room. One was super into her studies and trying to get everything done on time and trying to be ahead of the game. And the other one was like me, who was a severe procrastinator and ended up having to do cram sessions, which is exactly what I do when I'm researching now. But, you know, anyway. So the one who decided she wanted to be a procrastinator entered the her dorm room in the basement, which was kind of weird because I've never heard of a dorm room having a basement. But anyway.
Yeah.
So she entered the room through the basement door as soon as she realized she would have to pull an all-nighter to prepare for her final exam. Her roommate liked to get to bed early, so she tried to pack everything up that she thought she would need and went downstairs to study.
Why does this make me feel like it's the Amanda Knox case?
I don't even know what that is.
Oh my god, girl, when I cover it, you are in for a wild fucking ride.
Okay. Well, I don't think this is it. So
it's probably not, but anyways, continue.
Okay. So, she packed everything up that she thought she would need and she went downstairs to study. It was 2 a.m. when she finally realized the main textbook she was going to need was upstairs on her bed. So she climbed the stairs to her dorm room, reached the room, turned the handle, pushed in the door just enough to let a little bit of light slip inside so she wouldn't wake up her roommate. As soon as she entered the room, it was filled with a strange metallic smell, which she kind of pushed off. She said that she could hear her roommate breathing on the far side of the room, and it was heavy, almost as if she had been running. So she enters the room, she creeps along the wall until she reaches her bed, and then gropes around the covers to find her textbook.
I don't like this. Can you just stop?
No. So the room is completely silent other than the breathing, and she starts to hear a dripping sound.
Nope.
She decided she would have to call maintenance in the morning because they had been having problems with their shower. So she hurried back downstairs, and she studied until 6 o'clock in the morning and decided to go back to catch a few hours of sleep before her final exam. She opened the room to her dorm just as the sun was rising, and that's when she saw her roommate on top of her bed against the far wall. Her throat was cut from ear to ear. Her nightdress was stained with blood, and two drops of blood fell from the saturated blanket with a drip, drip noise that sounded like a leaky faucet. On the wall above her bed, written in her roommate's blood, were the words, "Aren't you glad you didn't turn on the light?"
Oh, God, no. Stop it. Stop. I hate you. Why are you doing this to me?
So there's another one, and just because I got that reaction, I wasn't going to tell it, but I'm going to tell it now.
God damn it, Katie.
I didn't record this one just because I don't like it.
God damn it.
Okay, so there was an older lady who lived in a little cottage with just her dog. And her dog had a little bed next to her bed, and every night she would roll over, pet the dog, and the dog would lick her fingers, roll over, and go to sleep.
Nope. Does the dog die? The dog dies, doesn't it? Oh, God damn it.
So, on this night, much, you know, the same as any other night, she rolled over, pet the dog, he licked her fingers, and she rolled over and went to sleep.
Oh my God, was it a person that licked her fingers?
I don't know. So she woke up at like 4 a.m. because she too heard a dripping sound, and she walked into her bathroom and saw her dog hanging from the shower curtain.
Oh God.
Whoever did it to her dog ended up severely hurting him to where he was bleeding, and the dripping noise that she heard was his blood. So she walks back into her bedroom and she finds a note on her bedside table that says, "Humans can lick too."
Oh my God, I was right. Oh God. No, what did she pet? Oh. Right. I hate you. I hate you so much.
Okay, moving on.
I don't know what it is, but the further we go into this podcast, the easier it is for me to freak the fuck out, and I don't like it, and I...
So, The next one is called The Corpse Bride, and there is a lot of truth to this one as far as I could find. The building this is surrounded by is true, and there are pictures of all of this, so I'll definitely include those as well, and then you guys can tell me what you think. For 75 years, a beautiful mannequin has stood in the window of a famous bridal shop in Chihuahua, Mexico. The mannequin has beautiful brown eyes, and her hair is in a perfect updo. Almost too perfect.
Oh my god, I know this one, I think.
Yeah, legend has it that the shop owner's daughter was set to get married on her wedding day. On that day, she was bit by a black widow spider, killing her not long after. The shop owner was so distraught, she had her daughter embalmed and placed in the window of her shop in her wedding dress. The mannequin has incredible detail, showing all the lines in her hand, the hair in her eyebrows, and even all of her fingernails. Yeah. Many refuse to believe the legend, stating that maybe it's just a wax figure made to look like the shop's daughter, or the shop owner's daughter. So I pulled pictures of this up, and I definitely think this is a body. I pulled up pictures of this mannequin, and I've never seen a mannequin this detailed. Of course, there are wax figures that are that detailed, but you can literally see all the lines in her hands. You can see, like, her cuticles. It's just really eerie. Like, super, super eerie. And I saw a picture of the shop owner's daughter, and it looks just like her.
Yeah. Is it possible she didn't embalm her daughter, but instead made, like, a death mask of her whole body?
I mean, that is very, very possible, but still creepy as hell.
I mean, abso-fucking-lutely. But slightly less creepy than, yeah, the body of my embalmed daughter is in the front of the store.
Right. Okay, so that was the end of that one. The next few I have are true urban legends.
I mean, were the others not?
The first two were, there were no, like, actual sources that say that's ever actually happened to someone, so I didn't want to include it in the true part and then it just be not true. And then the mannequin one, there's so much debate as to whether she's real, she's a wax figure or whatever. I didn't want to say that was true. Mm-hmm. And then people be like, that's definitely not true. And then that, like, brings me to the question, why not just run some kind of test on the mannequin? Unless, you know, maybe the shop owner won't allow that, but
I'd imagine the shop owner probably wouldn't allow that. But, like, also, I'm saying they're all true because it's far more fucking terrifying that way. And don't at me. I don't care.
Well, the true ones are just as bad as the others. So.
Great! I'm so excited for it. Yay!
All right. So the next one is Cropsey. Yeah. So in and around Staten Island, children in the 80s raised goosebumps by relating the tale of Cropsey. Cropsey was a boogeyman who lived in the woods and would capture and disembowel children. Parents, of course, told all the children that Cropsey didn't really exist to put their fears at ease. But he actually did.
Yeah.
In 1987, yeah. Andre Rand was put on trial and convicted for child abduction. Rand, it turned out, may have been connected to many child disappearances in the late 70s. He once worked at a mental institution, and that's where his sick, demented journey began. Rand also was suspected to be a serial killer of an unknown number of victims. He's currently alive. He is serving 25 years in prison for child abduction and will be eligible for parole in 2037.
That's still too soon. I don't care.
way too soon.
Ugh. We should cover that in, like, an actual true crime episode, though.
Yeah, definitely. Most of these I want to cover in a true crime episode. I didn't want to go into a lot of detail because some of these are super long.
Oh, yeah. Like, that one alone is, like, could be a multi-parter, so.
Absolutely. The next one is the body under the bed.
Yay! I think I know this one, too, and I hate it.
Yeah, so this has actually happened several times in several different cities, at least across the U.S. There have been cases of this happening in Virginia, California, North Carolina, South Carolina, Texas, Florida, and Colorado.
Nope.
Yeah.
I'm moving out of this state and moving to one that isn't on that list.
So, at least one couple slept on top of a body in Atlantic City in 1999. Yeah. Using hotel rooms to dispose of bodies is actually extremely common.
Yeah.
There have been countless accounts of cases of people having to call the front desk of hotels they were staying in complaining of foul odors, which almost always turned out to be dead bodies under their mattresses.
Mm-hmm.
There was a pretty popular case, which I'm not going to mention because I want to cover that in a true crime episode, and this body was under this bed for like 4 months.
Yeah.
So, gross. If you enter a hotel room and it smells funky,
don't stay there.
Do not stay there. Because someone was either cooking meth or coke or crack, or there's actually a body in there. So don't do it.
I don't even want to stay in a room if I find a fucking cockroach, let alone that.
No. Okay, so my next one, and this is my last one, is Candyman. Have you ever seen the Candyman movies?
I will kick your ass from here into next Tuesday, boy.
Okay, I'm gonna take that as a yes.
That was an absolute fucking yes. That movie is hilarious.
Okay, so in 1992, the movie Candyman was released. The movie was based on a short story by Clive Barker, who was murdered in the 1890s for having a relationship with a white woman. While it's not likely you'll be able to invoke him by saying his name several times in a mirror, the heart attack-inducing thought of having someone burst through a medicine cabinet at you is actually based on true events. In 1987, a story was published in the Chicago Reader about a woman named Ruth McCoy who lived in a Chicago housing project. Ruth made a frantic call to 911, hysterically telling the operator that she was being attacked in her apartment. Responders eventually found her dead of gunshot wounds. Mm-hmm. Investigators determined, Investigators determined that her assailants had gained access to her unit by breaking through the connecting wall in the adjoining apartment and climbing in through her medicine cabinet.
Yep.
The complex was built that way intentionally, so plumbers investigating leaks could simply remove the cabinet to check the pipes. It became a frequent mode of entry for burglars. And in Ruth's case, even murders.
Blah.
Yeah, so that definitely happened. That definitely terrifies me.
Yeah. I'm just really upset right now because I totally misquoted that. It's who can kick your ass from here to next Tuesday, boy? The Candyman can.
Yeah. Those movies are just creepy as hell to begin with.
Honestly, I don't find them creepy at all. I found them hilarious, and me and my friends would have what we called B-movie days, where we would just watch you know how you can go into Walmart and there's, like, the $5 movie bins?
Mm-hmm.
So we would just find whatever $5 movies were, like, the horror packs.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're always terrible. So we'd buy those and then we'd go and we'd spend like a whole day just binging these god-awful, horrendous horror movies.
Well, I think it terrified me because the first time I saw that movie, I think I was like 7.
See, that would do it. Like, I to this day can't watch, I think I mentioned it in the last episode or the itty bitty, I can't watch The Grudge.
Mm-hmm.
Because I saw it the year it came out, so I was very, very young, and that girl's face falling sideways and, like, her tongue hanging out just haunts me in my dreams, and the second that frickin' title screen pops up, I have to shut it off. I've tried, and
Yeah. So the Candyman movies and the Wishmaster movies scared the fuck out of me as a kid, along with the Leprechaun movies. The Wishmaster movies are fucking terrifying even now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I think they're on Hulu.
Maybe? Well, guess what Hulu does? They're doing a streaming thing somehow now.
Yeah.
So we could make that a live event for our $10 Patreons.
Yeah, that would be great.
You sound so disheartened, like, fuck this.
Those movies still fuck with me because I'm like, ugh, I just don't like it.
You want to see me get fucked up? Put not get fucked, guys. I'm not starting a porno. Let's not go there. The movie that fucks me up as bad as The Grudge would be Sinister.
I saw that movie.
All right, I'm going to make this episode slightly longer. So when I saw Sinister in, I saw it in theaters, and I saw it with my friend Hannah when I lived up in Washington, and I don't know if she remembers this, but so when we saw it, you know the part where the bad guy, spoiler alert for you guys if you haven't seen it, but I mean, it's been forever. So you know the part where Bagul, like, there's a still shot on the guy's laptop, and then all of a sudden, like, he looks away, and so the face moves. Mm-hmm. So at this same point, somebody walked into the movie theater, stood by the entrance, by the staircase, and just stared up at the audience. And all you could see of this person was that they had black hair. You could see the black of where their eyes should be, and then nothing else. And they just stared up at the audience for 5 minutes and then walked out.
No.
And it was at that exact part. And then it gets fucking worse. So I get home and I'm like, I can't sleep because that freaked me the fuck out. And so I'm sitting out in my living room. And at this point, I live with my aunt and uncle, and there's like this giant bay window. And directly across the street is like bushes with a street light illuminating them, very much like that one scene where there's the bushes illuminated and then his face pops out of it. Mm-hmm. So that didn't help. So I'm like, okay, I'm gonna go back to my room and just not deal with this. So I'm trying to go to bed, and I hear like creaking in the hallway. It's a two-story house though, so like that could be anything. But then I'm like, okay, I can't sleep. So I try to turn my bedside lamp on, and the light bulb fucking shattered, dude.
Oh no.
Like, I'm not even kidding you. And I texted my friend, and she was like, yeah, I'm hearing weird noises and like shit's happening, and I don't fucking like it. To this day, I will not watch Sinister. I don't care. You can't make me. Like, not a chance in hell. So anyways, that's my Sinister story, and I fucking hate it, and I hope you hate it too, guys. Just, no.
Yeah, no.
Horrible. And now now I just feel even more bleh.
So yeah, those were my urban legends.
Yeah, and I hope you don't feel like I stole your thunder. It just kind of came up, and just all of it.
It was relevant.
It was relevant, and I loved your stories, and you did a really amazing job, and I will have trouble sleeping tonight.
Good.
So,
good thanks.
Job. Good job. All right, Katie, I am so excited for your CTKs this week. Tell the world, what were your chills, thrills, and kills?
Okay, so I quit my job.
Yay! I'm going to try and edit in cheering noises. We'll see how that goes.
So I had been at this company for 5-6 years. That's definitely up for debate. I say 6. My employment profile says 5, but I know that's incorrect just because I keep track of everything. But either way.
Cute.
I quit my job.
I wonder if their taxes are accurate.
I don't know. But anyway, so I quit that job and it felt really, really great. I used to drive 3 hours a day to go to work, and I didn't get to spend much time with my family. Recording was hell because I literally had no chance to research except on Sundays, and we tried to record on Sundays. So most of the time I was just cramming all the information I could, typing up my notes, and then recording all in the same day, which made me really, really tired. So my stories will probably be way more detailed because now I'll have all the free time in the world because I don't work weekends now.
She doesn't work weekends, and her work is so much closer to her house, yeah. And I'm so excited for you.
Super excited. So, my other one is I have recently not really come back in contact with a close friend, but we've started hanging out again, and I have a severe allergy to cats, like severe. But I'm one of those people that if a cat comes up to me, I'm not going to push it away. Like, I want to pick it up and love it and, you know, all of that. So I went to my friend's house, and she has a cat named Capkin, and he's humongous. He's, like, so fat and so cute and fluffy. And we were sitting in her living room, and he jumps in my lap, and I'm, like, loving all over him. He's rolling all over my face and, like, pawing at my hands. He's so cute. So we go and sit on her front porch, and he goes out there with us, and I'm petting him the whole time, and then I go to go home, and when I get into my car, my eye starts watering.
Yeah.
And I knew I was going over there. She's had this cat for, like, 3-4 years now, so I knew that he was there, but I didn't take any allergy medicine because I'm a fucking idiot. So I get home, and I walk in, and Stuart's like, whoa. And I'm like, what? And he's like, what the fuck is wrong with your eye? So at this point, only my right eye is, like, swollen shut. My throat is scratchy. I'm having a hard time breathing. So I took, like, a handful of Benadryl and passed out for, like, 2 hours. So I feel a lot better right now, thank God, because I have work tomorrow. But, yeah, what were your CTKs for this week?
Let's see, mine, I bought a refrigerator today, which is kind of like, I'm happy about it, but I'm also annoyed about it because money, but I've been wanting to meal plan for a really long time, but sharing one refrigerator in a home full of 5 people, especially when it's like, our appliances are not high-end by any means, so like, a lot of people can make sharing a refrigerator between 5 people and meal planning work, but that's if you have one of those really fancy refrigerators that are huge. Mm-hmm. We have one where, like, the fridge is maybe, I don't know, 1 foot wide, and then the freezer's 1 foot wide.
Yikes.
So that's just not a thing we can do. So I'm really happy because our freezer, or our fridge, gets here on the 23rd, I think. And then our stove/oven... I have not had an oven I could bake in over a year, and I'm so fucking stoked about it. So our oven gets here the day after, so I feel like a real adult. I'm having appliances arrive, and I get more excited over appliances than, like, anything else, and it's fucking ridiculous. I don't know. Also, I got to buy the most adorable shoes. I haven't owned a pair of sneakers in, like, 3 years because I wear, like, ballet flats daily and sandals, but, or heels because heels, but they're the cutest, so they're Tom's brand, sponsor us, and they have glow-in-the-dark aliens on them, or as I like to say, because I'm a Rugrats baby, aliums with an M.
I say that
M.
too.
I love that. Twinsies. Yeah, so I will be getting the most adorable alium shoes on the same day I get my refrigerator, and
that's
coming up roses,
week.
You guys. It's going to be a great week. Plus, I'm expecting something from Katie at some point. I don't know when, but yay.
Yeah, that's a whole... Oh, okay, well, I want to add to my CTKs then.
Okay, I'm guessing you weren't able to ship something out.
Okay, so, the city I live in, we literally have, like, 6 post offices within, like, a 10-mile radius from me.
That's a lot, okay.
So, yeah, especially because I live in a small town, a small city, but anyway. So I go to the one closest to my house... And I don't have packing tape at my house, which I guess is something I need to invest in.
I guess.
So I go up there and I'm like, hey, I need to purchase some packing tape so I can tape up this box so I can get it weighed so I can send it off. And the lady's like, okay, well, you can buy packing tape, but we won't have it in store until next week. Excuse me?
What?
You're a fucking post office. You can't just, like... hand me your little gun that you tape boxes shut with and let me use your tape. No.
Not to mention, you can't just pay extra to have them tape it.
Tape it? Exactly. So she just could not be inconvenienced at all. So I just walked out after that. I went to another one and they told me that the processing time to get the package out of their post office was like a week, which I just think is ridiculous. So I think I'm just going to drive to another city that's not far from here, because I'm impatient and I feel like if they tell me it's going to be there in 4 days, it needs to be there in 4 days and not 11 days. So yeah, I'm going to drive, since I will be off of work before everything in the world closes. Yay. I think I'm just going to drive out tomorrow and first off buy some fucking packing tape.
If you have dollar stores near you, they sell like these tiny things of packing tape, so that might be an option.
Yeah, so I'm going to find some packing tape. I was going to get some really cute duct tape to like cover the box in just to be an asshole. But I couldn't find any of that either.
Well, not to mention if you cover the whole box in it, chances are they're going to choose your box to open and inspect it. So
right, and I mean there's nothing in there that would trigger anything as to, you know, it not being able to be sent, but there, I would be very upset if something got taken out of the box. So
exactly.
And I'm honestly thinking of just skipping the post office altogether and shipping it out of like a FedEx thing.
There's yeah, I one. Usually ship stuff out of like postal annexes. They're just really fast about it.
Yeah, so I would just rather do that, and then I can just pay for it to be like expedited or whatever.
Oh my god, don't even bother. Seriously.
Well, I'm annoyed and I don't want to put it in the mail and then, like I said, them tell me it's going to take 4 days and it takes 7 days. So I would just rather have that receipt. That way I could be like, hey, my package isn't there. What the fuck is going on?
Well, so, that, and you can also give me tracking info since I rarely leave my room. That way I'll know when it gets here so I can make sure my neighbors don't steal it.
Yeah. So hopefully that journey will conclude tomorrow and the beginning of it for you will start. So yay! I'll definitely let you know how that goes. But and everybody and their freaking mom was at the post office when I went. I don't know why, but it this package... Okay, I really hope you enjoy this package.
If you are sending it to me, I will cherish it always. I won't even throw away the box, Katie.
Okay, good, because I decorated it.
Aw, no, I definitely won't. I'm starting to slowly compile your birthday box.
Yeah, I've started on that too. I'm a little embarrassed to say I have an entire room of a corner of my room dedicated to it. But yeah.
I love how similar we are. I literally, like, I start Christmas, I haven't this year because of COVID, but I usually start Christmas shopping, like, the second Christmas is over, and I just, like, as I'm shopping for other things, I'm like, oh, this looks like this person would like it. Purchase. Set aside. I'm insane. I'm nuts, you guys.
Yeah.
All right, Jesus. Well... I guess we should probably wrap this up.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
Yeah. So if you like us, maybe even love us, please, 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 please support us on Patreon so that we can give you more content and have tons of fun. So you can find that at patreon.com/ctkpod. Or you can send us mail now, you guys. Please send us mail. I had to pay for this P.O. box, so it would be really, 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 really great if we could get some mail. Plus, we want to do, like, fun episodes where we read some of the stuff on either, like, at the end of an itty-bitty or as a bonus episode or whatever. I don't know. So you can do that. Make it out to Chills, Thrills, and Kills. And the address is 520 North Ventu Park Road, number 273 in Newberry Park, California, 91320. And that will be in the show notes as always. Or if you don't feel like doing that because you're lazy like me and don't believe in snail mail, you can find us on Twitter.
At CTKPod.
Or you can find us on Instagram.
At CTKPod.
And you can join our Facebook group where we have a lot of fun at
CTK Podcast. You can also send us any listener stories, any interesting stories, funny stories, literally everything you send, we read, and I absolutely love it. But you can send those stories to chillsthrillsandkills@gmail.com.
Yes, actually, please, please, please send in listener stories if you have them, if you've been sitting on them. send them in. We are quickly approaching the first of next month, which is wild. And we would love to be able to give you guys another listener story episode, but I think we only have like one unread one, or we have two, I think, unread ones at the moment. So send those in.
Yeah, and don't, like, if you have multiple stories, you can send in multiple stories. We read two stories from Dominique last month for our listener stories, and so don't think just because you have multiple ones they won't get read. We'll definitely read whatever we get, and also don't think it has to be paranormal. It can be a funny true crime story. It could be you realized you live next to a murderer. It could be you are involved in a bank heist. Whatever. Let us know.
Yeah, or like your one cousin's friend told you something really weird about how they dated a murderer on Tinder. Just something fun.
Right.
Just whatever.
Let us know.
Yeah. But otherwise, that about does it. So see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.